and Measures Services. Let me drop for a second.
Bug was in there, K2, I say Y was in there, maybe it's coming through the Selman repeater and you didn't hear him, Doug. Roy.
No, I did not hear Doug. Let me pause and see if Doug wants to say something.
Doing to SAY. You were asking about the name of the radio. It doesn't seem to have one. The only thing I can do is tell you what kind of a chip it has in it, and I have to go get it to find out. It's not in front of me right at the moment. So stay in, I'll come back in a couple of minutes.
Okay, Doug, you can either do that, or I sent you some email, and if you just go into the email and just reply to my email, I'll see if I can dig out some information for you over the next week. How's that?
My email address?
I found your email address on QRZ and sent you email. Hopefully it's the same email address.
It's been the same for years.
Okay, so it should be sitting there waiting for you to read and reply to. Just write down as much information as you can find, and I'll see if I can help you out.
This is WH2SAY listening out.
Very good. Okay, on with the show. Getting back, even today, it's all based on comparison, what the kilo is. Legrand K remains secured under lock and key in Paris. Countries can get copies of Legrand K and then must use scales calibrated to the copy of the real thing. But it's possible that something can get lost in the bucket brigade, and of course there's a chance the original goes missing or gets destroyed. Comparisons with copies already revealed that the mass of the kilogram has slightly changed, albeit an incredibly tiny amount. It's possible the copies absorbed the molecules from the air, or the original lost mass through washing or other physical processes. The proposal to be voted on next week would drop the kilogram as the last unit still based on a physical object on the Earth. Instead, we would use the universe itself as a measure. Built into the fabric of space-time are fundamental constants that scientists can measure in experiments. The speed of light in a vacuum is always going to be the same velocity. 299,792,458 meters per second. The ratio of a light particle's energy to its frequency is equal to 6.6260715 times 10 to the minus 34th joule second, where joules units are kilograms times meters squared over seconds squared. This number is called the Planck's constant. Meters and seconds have already been redefined by the International Bureau of Weights and Measures to align with the speed of light and the vibration of cesium atoms. Kilogram would now be defined based on the fixed value of Planck's constant. Let me drop for a second. In practice, those hoping to determine the amount of mass equal to a kilogram would use a device called a Kibble balance. Now, that's named after the inventor, Professor Kibble. It used to be called a watt balance, which measures an amount of electromagnetic force required to balance a test mass. The vote is scheduled for November 16th, and the resolution is expected to go through. So, if you really want to understand mass, it might be time to learn a little quantum mechanics. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
There were a number of articles over the last year about a standard object to be, I think, a kilogram, which was a pure chunk of silicon made into a super smooth spherical object. I thought that was going to be proposed as a substitute for the kilogram. Here we go. Roy, go ahead.
That was going to be used as a kind of intermediary method. That the ball uses a calculation based on Avogadro's number, which is also an inherent constant. So you can either define a kilogram on the basis of what Avogadro's constant is to the nth significant digit, or you can use a Planck's constant using a triple meter. as a triple scale as the method of calculating. They're both based on universal constants. Avogadro's number is for chemistry. Planck's constant is more physics.
So is the new proposal for the kilogram an amount of force that's created in an electromagnetic manner? Go ahead.
Yes, it's the amount of force that balances the gravitational force of a kilogram. What they did was they designed the Kibble scale to incredible accuracy. They placed the standardized 1 kilogram weight onto it, and by using calculations, they came up with a very, very precise measurement for the Planck's constant. And you can just go turn it completely around and use the Planck's constant then to measure the weight of objects on the triple scale.
I see a problem with that. Depending on what the local gravity constant is, and that's, you can see maps of the Earth where there are certain places where gravity is stronger and weaker. So I will get a different answer on that balance scale, where I'm creating electromagnetic force on one side of the scale, I've got a physical object on the other side of the scale, and depending on my local gravity constant, I think I could get different answers. Over to you, Roy. See, what I'm basically saying is the apparent weight of that kilogram object will be higher or lower depending on what my local gravity constant happens to be. If I was foolish enough to make that measurement on top of Mount Everest, I'd get a very different answer.
Well, Dick, you're absolutely right, but the scientists have you covered on that. They actually did gravitational studies of the Kibble measuring device, and Veritasium, one of your favorite YouTubes. I'm going to post a link to Veritasium's YouTube on the subject. They show the scientists have a scale model of the gravitational differences in the room, and they're taken into account. So you are correct that gravity has an effect, but if you know that gravity has an effect, you can measure the effect and null it out.
Okay. Does that mean I can measure the gravity constant in my particular environment with enough decimal places that I therefore have confidence in the overall answer?
If you do it in a very precise manner, the way these guys did, apparently yes. They pretty much figured out how many significant digits they need. So I would assume it's possible. It probably takes a long time. It's probably rather expensive, but I think it's doable.
I measure it with, Dick.
Okay. Your next question is, how do you measure gravity constant accurately? I know that they've done it for submarines. Submarines can don't have to come to the surface anymore to figure out where they are. They don't need global positioning satellites. They have mapped the gravity constant for the sea floor almost everywhere in the world. So as you move the submarine and you watch the gravity constant go up and down, you very rapidly figure out exactly where you are to match the map that's already been measured. I think that's part of the answer you're asking for, Doug. I guess what I think Doug is asking, Roy, is by what means do you measure the gravity constant of your particular environment? AC2GS, K2RIW.
Comment, it's mass.
Excuse me, what mass? We'll get mass. But the way they do it is they drop weights and they look at the velocity of the weight falling. It changes according to fluctuations in the local gravitational field.
Yeah, Roger. Local gravitational field, exactly, which would have to do with mass, I would believe. You look at Neil Armstrong, where he dropped the eagle's feather and the hammer, and they fell at the same rate. KD2PPF, thanks for letting me chime in.
You're welcome. But yeah, that's why we don't live in a perfect sphere. There are slight density changes and slight surface changes, so we don't live in a perfect environment where the gravitational force is identical across the surface of the entire Earth. But as I said before, it's as simple and as tedious as dropping little weights and measuring time intervals all over the place within the test area.
So you're dropping weights and measuring the number of milliseconds or seconds to a ridiculous number of decimal places as to how long it takes for the dropped weight to pass a second gate. But now you've got a number of things going on here simultaneously. Wind resistance, you've got to account for that. Temperature of the air. The distance at which you're dropping the weight. Maybe you're dropping the weight exactly 2 meters. You've got to worry about the accuracy of those 2 meters of drop, as well as the accuracy of the timing of when the weight crosses that second gate. That doesn't sound very simple. Over to you, Roy, KTRIW.
Well, I would think on a theoretical basis it's a simple way to explain it, but in the practical and engineering means, it requires very smart people. You don't really have to worry too much about wind resistance and such. You're doing it in an enclosed area. This is the triple scale that we're talking about. So you could close it up and seal it up and vacuum it if you wanted to. But probably they don't need to quite go that far. And you build equipment with very, very precisely measured top and bottom. You know what the distance is. You have a very accurate time standard. And you just go around the entire surface of the floor of your triple scale, dropping the little ball and taking the time measurement.
So are you saying they've used this instrumentation and with a room... If I go to the north corner and the south corner and the east corner of the room, are you telling me I will measure slightly different gravitational constants that I can resolve? Is that what you're saying, Roy?
Yes, if your test equipment is precise enough, you will. And if anyone goes to my website and clicks the link for the Veritasium YouTube, you will see a beautiful 3D model of the gravitational fluctuations in the triple room. They've not only calculated it, but they've rendered it as a 3D object, and you can see the video exactly where some of the specimens that are used for the experiment add additional mass into the room and cause a slight gravitational fluctuation at those areas.
I guess the possibility existed that from my particular building, like the one where... PBS television used to be located, has a very large power transformer in the basement that steps down the multi-kilovolt voltage coming into the building down to the 220 volts, that actually 240 volts, two-phase that's fed through the building. If your particular office sits above that very heavy transformer, you will see a greater gravity constant on that corner of the room because of what's in the basement.
Yes, fortunately, our sensitivity is nowhere close to it, so we would never notice and be discomforted by it, because if we were discomforted by such things, we would find them all over the place. This is not a uniform globe we live on. It's a rather lumpy one. But it's sort of fascinating. I mean, the subject alone on the YouTube is very fascinating, but just to look at the gravimetric... projections and the 3D model that they built, what was, at least to me, was fascinating to see. It exaggerated the differences, obviously, for scale, so that people looking at know what's going on. Because, you know, if you really did it in parts per million, it would look like a very flat surface.
I think you're saying you believe that the new technique that's being proposed has been tried enough times in enough locations to prove to them that it had the reliability they're looking for and the repeatability. That a person, I guess you have to buy this piece of test equipment. I don't think you can easily reproduce it. So a person in Timbuktu to come up with a standard kilogram this is the right way to do it. It's been tested enough times to prove it has repeatability, reliability, ease of use, and so on. Over to you, Roy, KTRIW.
Well, November 16th, the Power B will get together and vote yay or nay, and it looks like it's going to be yay because it's true, it's cumbersome to build these things, although it was cumbersome to build accurate time systems once upon a time, and now they're shrinking and getting smaller and smaller. But the beauty of this is you don't have to invest in a silicon ball, you have to invest in a kilogram that's hidden away someplace in France. You just can build your own triple scale, plug in the numbers, and come up with your own kilogram standard. And that's the beauty of all this. What really they all wanted to do was remove that problem of having a physical standard sitting there that if you lose it, you lose the standard. We've now defined it in terms that can remain unchangeable. You could bash Lagrand K, you can change the gravitational field of the Earth, but a kilogram under the definition that they're going to accept will remain a kilogram.
Do you know the approximate number of decimal places that the kilogram is calibratable to by this procedure? Is it one part per million, one part per billion? Over to you, Roy.
Well, I think they've calibrated Planck's constant to, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, about 10 digits. So that's kind of the limitation, I would think, although it might be that the article is simply shortening it for the sake of the reader's sanity. So I haven't actually read how many numbers it goes through, but I would assume it's the best you're going to get, because now what's going to happen, unfortunately or fortunately, is they're going to kind of lock it down. So it sort of ends up redefining kilograms ever so slightly. So I think the remaining significant numbers kind of get lost in the dust.
And this new testing procedure will be compared against the real kilogram object that's kept in that vault in France. Go ahead.
Well, it's my understanding that if they didn't use Lagrand K as the test object, which is very likely that they didn't, they probably used one of the sister kilogram samples in the triple scale itself to calculate the lockdown number of Planck's constant.
Do you know the approximate amount of error they were getting on the sister items when they compared it to the one in France? Are we talking about, again, the 10th decimal place, which is one part per 10 billion? Go ahead.
Yes, it was smaller than one part in a million. It was probably somewhere close to parts in billions, which didn't annoy them too much, but the trend was troublesome. I mean, the problem with this kind of measurement system is if you touch the thing, you've changed its mass. So you pretty much have to keep it clean and polished and not allow even dust to settle, not even you have to find something that's not going to evaporate, because unfortunately all solids do evaporate over time, but platinum has a very, very, very low evaporation rate. So it's a very minuscule difference. It's still livable. But it was concerning to the people enough to kind of hurry on this alternate method of calculating and standardizing a kilogram thing that's unaffected by anything in the physical world.
So the master reference kilogram in France is made out of either platinum or a platinum alloy. Go ahead.
Yes, it's a platinum alloy.
And you believe they know the evaporation rate of that platinum alloy, or is it kept in some kind of a standard atmosphere that negates the evaporation?
I think they've measured it in other fields of science to be incredibly minuscule. It's one of the reasons they chose that material, because of its lack of correction. Oxidation will complicate things. Evaporation would complicate things. But I mean, ultimately, if you hold on to that, to the Lagrange K for a billion years, it's going to partially evaporate. So it's more of a matter of time and more of a theoretical problem. There's more problems with the platinum alloy due to erosion or getting some kind of contaminant on it than evaporation, but ultimately things do evaporate.
When you've got something with that many decimal places of mass accuracy and you want to make a comparison measurement today, how do you pick it up and move it to the test apparatus without disturbing it?
With great difficulty, with great care, and that's probably why they made the sister weights, which is the ones that they kind of ship around for real heavy-duty inspection outside of France. So they probably don't want to lose track of Lagrange K personally, so they measure it against the daughter kilograms, and they send the daughter kilograms out. But you know, everything is done with kit gloves, if you will, and then some.
To your knowledge, when it comes to all the standards, the Grand K kilogram, is that the last standard we have left that's still being, up till now, kept as a physical object? Almost everything else is a more universal measurement, like frequency being X number of cycles of a cesium beam. Go ahead.
Yes, thankfully, this is the very last one. France doesn't have anything in its vault other than the Lagrange K. All the other physical constants have been redefined as mathematical concepts and vibrations and such. They're all nicely interrelated to each other, and this is the last version of an actual physical anchor that could easily be smashed into dust. But yeah, this was the last one, and now they're all in the textbooks, and you can pull them out of the textbook anytime that you want, and you don't have to travel to France.
The length of 1 meter is now being defined as X number of cycles of a cesium beam. I think it starts off something like 9 billion cycles. To really make that measurement sounds tedious. They must have some shortcut methods where you appear to be measuring all 9,000 cycles, 9 billion cycles, but I'll bet it's done with a more simple manner. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sure the scientists and the engineers have all kinds of incredibly brilliant ways of getting around things, but as long as you can kind of define it, once you can define it, you're not going to every day use that as a measuring tool. You'll use that to develop real models, but if the model breaks, then you go back to the lab and you generate a new model and you just keep doing it until you get tired of doing it. So, yeah, I'm sure there are ways to make it much easier. I'm sure there are very clever guys who've come up with very clever methods. I mean, the Kibble balance is a perfect example of something very clever that thankfully is named after the guy. He's passed away. But it's got to be easier than it sounds. I mean, it sounds scientifically nice to me personally, but it must be a pain in the backside to actually do in a lab. And as long as we were talking about Planck's constant, just in case anyone is vaguely interested in Planck's constant, it's named after Max Planck, who is a brilliant scientist, kind of either the father or the grandfather of quantum mechanics, if you will. And there's a little story about that. You know, we all always think that theoretical physics is very, very abstract and people just do it for the sake of doing it and there's no practical value. But Max Planck had a very practical monetary value for it. You see, he was trying to explain how black body radiation works. And that's non-reflective objects. If you heat them up, they radiate electromagnetic energy at different spectrums in different proportions as you heat them. But no one could quite figure out how to know that. There were some very smart guys. There was Rayleigh of Rayleigh scattering, who came up with the Rayleigh gene equation, which was very nice for low frequencies, but if you got the temperature too hot, then the equation was completely worthless. And the guys who built light bulbs for a living really wanted to know this stuff because they need to know what temperature to make their filaments so the light bulbs are the brightest in the visible light range. Let me drop for a second. AC2GS. So the story that comes down in history is Max Planck was sitting in a train. Apparently Germans spent a lot of times in trains. There's stories about Einstein coming up with relativity on a train. Max Planck was sitting on a train and he was thinking in terms of the experimental values for black body radiation that had been measured for 50, 60 years that no one could come up with an equation. And he played a little game. He curved fit an equation. In other words, he just got together a whole bunch of different variables and relationships to variables and moved them around until they simulated the shape of the curves that experimentally were gotten. And he came up with two interesting constants in this equation. One, he was kind enough to donate and name after a Boltzmann, the Boltzmann constant. And the other one, everyone decided to name after him the Planck's constant. And that's the origin of Planck's constant and Boltzmann's constant. The funny thing, though, and he won a Nobel Prize for that, but the funny thing is that he was always a little bit annoyed because he would have rather figured it out how it works and then come up with the equation rather than just fit an equation for experimental results, because it took 15 more years for everyone to figure out what the equation really meant. It was very obscure at the time, and it was the kind of original concept behind quantum mechanics. But when Einstein came up with the photoelectric effect that really shined a light on quantum mechanics, Max Planck thought that Einstein was completely...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Sorry about that. Anyway, Max Planck really didn't believe in the quantum nature of reality. He thought that they were just resonators. And Einstein won his Nobel Prize on the photoelectric effect. And for at least 5-10 years, Max Planck, who was a great believer in Einstein generally and in relativity, he didn't really agree with him. It took time for him to come over to it. So that's a kind of real short story of how the Planck's constant that's going to be used to define kilograms came into existence and the people that brought it in there. You know, there's human lives that come with all of these stories. We kind of separate them out and just give it to you in black and white and equations. But if anyone's interested, read up on Max Planck. He was a very, very interesting fellow. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
And to Rio, I've stated, Einstein and everybody else, it's amazing how they're able to do this when there were no computers.
Oh, yes and no, Richie, because a lot of these things didn't really require heavy-duty computational studies. Nowadays, when we have these very long equations and complex interrelationships and very, very complicated models, you can plug them into computers and get kind of answers. They might be right, they might be wrong. But back then, it was more conceptual. You couldn't go to a computer today and get it to tell you that energy is quantized, that time and space are relative, not inherent constants in the universe. So computers do symbol manipulation very nicely, very quickly, much quicker than any human being. but there are some leaps of understanding that are beyond the serial nature of the standard model computer these days.
I've seen pictures of Einstein's theory of his theories of equation written down. First of all, I don't know how he was able to follow through without a computer. It's also crazy that the Nazis considered him an inferior, which is crazy.
Richard, you're an asshole. K6DB, sir.
Richard, you have to understand, Nazi Germany were anti-Semitic and racist. Some of the physicists in Germany supported Jewish physicists. There were some physicists in Germany, some who had Nobel Prizes as well, who hated the Jewish physicists, who called quantum mechanics and theoretical physics, quote, Jewish physics, and had no taste for it whatsoever. So hatred is an irrational emotion, and it leads to irrational things. They basically, thankfully, threw out all the guys who knew how to build atomic bombs, and they moved to the United States, and the rest is, as they say, history.
Hitler was a jerk. He used the Jews and the Poles. He would have ruled the world, the asshole.
Yes, I know. No, everybody knows that. But, I'm wondering how Einstein was able to keep track of all the things he wrote down on paper. It's amazing.
Now, I'm sure he had the gist of what he wrote down. I don't know if he memorized everything. And you also have to realize, once again, nothing happens in a vacuum. He didn't come up with all the mathematics solely by himself. There are a slew of colleagues that he worked with to kind of fine-tune. He was not really great at mathematics. He was more a conceptual type of a guy. You know, I hate the phrase, but thinking outside the box. But as far as the mathematics, he asked around people, and there's a whole bunch of people who are actually embedded within the fabric of all of Einstein's equations. There are Lorentz transforms, which go back 20, 30 years before Einstein did the theory of relativity. So again, we are all standing on the shoulders of giants, and that includes Einstein, although he was a giant as well.
Einstein was pretty involved with Manhattan Project.
Fine. I'll turn back to you. You can pick up whoever you want. M2EO.
6DPZ with a comment.
Okay, so I assume you've gotten my message for Planck's constant and that little story. And hopefully one of these days I'll tell you a story of other scientists. They're all clever, and they're all unique people, and smart as hell. And, you know, I wish I knew one bit of as much as some of these guys do. So let me move on to my next subject, and we'll cover that one. Let me drop for a second, and then we move on.
E6DPZ with a comment. Am I right to speak? Boyce, can I have my right to speak?
On to the next story. Next story is about some interstellar driftwood that's been making news in one way or another for over a year. And recently, a very strange paper written by a Harvard professor and one of his graduate students has brought it back into the news. It was the main topic of this week's Astronomy Net. On October 19th, 2017, a strange object from outside the solar system whizzed by the Earth, exciting scientists and non-scientists alike. It was picked up using the Pan-STARRS telescope at the Halikia Observatory 40 days after it passed its closest point to the Sun. When first seen, it was already 21 million miles away from us, traveling on a hyperbolic course at a velocity of 58,893 miles an hour. Immediately, some people speculated that this interstellar visitor could be an alien spacecraft. A variety of news outlets have been reporting this week that the Harvard scientists say that the object might be an alien visitor. And in fact, the researchers did say that, but there are some nuances to dig into here. Let me drop for a second. On Oumuamua's arrival, which is Hawaiian for the first distant messenger, scientists found that the object measured 800 meters by 80 meters by 80 meters. That's approximately a half mile long and 260 feet in diameter. It was tumbling all over the place, and it was taking a hyperbolic pathway through the solar system. In other words, it wasn't orbiting the sun. Its angle and speed suggested it was visiting and then leaving. Professionals immediately pointed out that no, it's not an alien spacecraft because its trajectory doesn't look like the kind that thrusters would produce. Still, it appears to have an anomalous acceleration other than what gravity would cause. Scientists wondered where it came from and determined that it might have been a comet, but it appeared not to be outgassing like a comet. The mystery remains to this day as to what it truly is. A new paper from Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics researchers Shmuel Bialy and Avi Loeb explored an idea to explain where the extra acceleration came from. Let me for a second. Perhaps it could be solar radiation pressure, an extra transfer of momentum coming from the sun's electromagnetism. The paper goes into how the object must look in order for solar radiation pressure to create the observed acceleration. So, Loeb and Bialy write in their paper, posted on a non-peer-reviewed website, maybe Oumuamua is just an incredibly thin object. They then devoted the end of the paper to speculation that it could be a solar radiation-propelled spaceship. While these claims are extraordinary, it's hard to prove them false, so indeed, Oumuamua could be a solar radiation-propelled alien spaceship. That doesn't mean it's likely to be one, though. Let me drop for a second. Other scientists were skeptical of the paper. It's important not to take advantage of your institution's brand to over-fly results that are unverified or highly speculative, a physics not connected with Harvard, the Harvard paper stated. It doesn't just affect the department's reputation, it also affects the rest of the field. Harvard's Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics astronomer Jonathan McDowell has said that it's less likely that the object is a spaceship and more likely that one of our current assumptions about the object is completely wrong. Loeb responded to the reaction of the paper by saying that, quote, the hypothesis was purely scientific and that once the impossible has been excluded, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the answer, end quote. So apparently he's read a lot of Sherlock Holmes stories when he was younger. He said that the evidence is not conclusive but interesting, and that he welcomes other proposals but cannot think of another explanation for the peculiar acceleration of Oumuamua. Loeb has previously described his interest in studying interstellar objects for science, for signs of alien life. He's also chairing an initiative called Breakthrough Starshot, which hopes to build a solar sail just like the one he claims Oumuamua might be. Let me drop for a second. So, Oumuamua, an alien spaceship. Who knows? It's not impossible, but there are much more plausible explanations that have yet to be ruled out. Some have suggested that outgassing materials were trapped within the object. Others have postulated some gravitational object or solar system that we might have failed to notice yet. More important than Professor Loeb's nebulous theory, I wonder what he and his graduate students were smoking or drinking when they came up. Scientists believe that over 46 million interstellar objects pass by our solar system every single year, but they're too small and they're too far away from us to detect them. Oumuamua acts a bit like a comet and a bit like an asteroid, but not enough to fit into either category. So right now it's referred to just as an interstellar object. Right now, although no longer visible to us, it is still believed to be hurtling through our solar system at a speed believed to be 26 kilometers a second. But even at that incredible speed, it will take another 20,000 years to fully clear our solar system. So don't expect to catch up with it anytime soon. Our fastest non-gravity-assisted rockets, like those used on the New Horizon mission, were only capable of providing about 16 and a quarter kilometer per second velocity. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
this is AC2 GS.
2N.
Yes, Paul.
At that speed, it's not coming back. It's not gonna go like out to the Oort cloud and then eventually come back. It's not in orbit around our sun. So that speed, that's why they're saying it's an interstellar object.
Yeah, Paul, it's going too fast. It's off the plane of our lovely little solar system, completely in a different angle. It dropped by, it did a slingshot around the sun, and now it's flying away. And if anyone wants to see it, again, I just asked them to look at the web browser and type in roy.ac2gs.com. I have two pictures. I have an image of what, unfortunately, astronomers had to deal with in looking at Oumuamua, just a little white blob, and I have a nice little diagram of the trajectory of Oumuamua going through the solar system with dates, where it was at different times and where it will be in the future. So if you have a chance in a browser, check it out.
And boy, they have the guy on, the scientist on that discovered all of this, and he thinks it's only a 1% chance that it's some type of intelligent life. Just don't hold your breath. But he was on a news show. They call it what is it? It's the Optimum Station, which 102 here. It's an all news station.
I would tend to give it a trillion and one chance because it's not operating like anything we know. They've looked for electromagnetic energy. There is none. They've looked for heat energy. There is none. It's not only is it's rolling around in an erratic way that if there were aliens in it, they would probably be puking up their guts. So I think it is incredibly unlikely that there's anyone aboard.
I hope not. I hope not. This reminds me of that Hale-Bopp situation. There was a Hale-Bopp comet. Everybody that wanted to see this thing went out and looked. You didn't need a telescope, and it really made the news back when it showed up. But then there was a group called Heaven's Gate that said there are intelligent people hiding behind in a spacecraft behind Hale-Bopp comet, and they dropped up this whole scheme, and eventually they all killed themselves out in California somewhere. Like dozens of these people, I don't know how many, belong to Heaven's Gate. I'd have to look it up. But they all believe there was intelligent life behind Hale-Bopp comet. I hope we don't get another group like that with this thing. Back to you, Rory. WS2S.
Paul, I think there's a better chance, there's a much better chance, that there'll be people who start a religion based on Oumuamua more than there's a chance that there's someone actually inside there. People are curious things. We have people who believe in the flat Earth. So if you can believe that the Earth is not round, that all the planets are just cutouts, disks and such, and everything that we know to be true, satellites and gravity, doesn't really exist, then you can believe that Oumuamua has a full orchestra playing out there.
Yeah, that's not good, not good. Well, yeah, they started, like, this one guy, he started the group up. So it was almost like a religion. And he got all these followers. And they all kill themselves out in California. They thought by doing it at a certain time that they were going to wind up with these aliens behind the Hale-Bopp comet and they were going to fly off, you know, Nevada somewhere. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, it was your basic. So they thought that they were going to transport their souls onto the mother ship, and the aliens would provide new bodies for them, and they'd go flying off into the cosmos. It was a curious belief. One wonders where it came from, but having done a rotation in psychiatry, I can pretty much picture exactly where it came from.
One and two out.
That's right. You refresh my memory. You're right. Very good. I heard Rich.
Yes, Rich. What would you like to say?
Yeah, boy. My good buddy, Barry, M2MB, believes that we're the only people or the only civilization, I guess that's the way you put it, in the cosmos, because he said we've been looking and looking and haven't found any other civilization. It's a valid point. But, you know, we're communicating in a way that maybe is the way we think.
VDH with a comment.
SVDH.
Roy, was it a close enough flyby? I know it was a hyperbolic orbit, but was it a close enough flyby that it got a significant boost in its velocity? Go ahead.
Yes, I mean, initially, if you take a look at the website, roy.ac2gs, you can see that it was close by Venus, I think, when it circled the sun and then did a further hyperbolic. When we first noticed it, it had gone past Mars already. And, you know, an 800-meter object that's past Mars to be able to pick up on a telescope, if we didn't have the new Pan-STAR, we would have missed it even then.
Roy?
Yes, Rich. I just wanted to answer VDH's question and see if he had any response, and then we'll get right back to you.
But I was wondering, after it did the flyby of the sun, after it passed the sun, was it a significant increase in its velocity? In other words, did it actually have a velocity gain due to that, the gravitational assist from the close flyby of the sun?
Oh, yes, that's my understanding. It had a gravitational assist from the sun. The problem, though, is that as they measured its rate of escaping the solar system, it seemed to have an unexpected, slightly increased acceleration that's difficult for scientists to come up with an easy solution for. So there's an extra non-gravitational acceleration in its pathway that's yet to be fully explained. And thus, you get the solar sails, and you get the aliens, and all kinds of fun stuff.
I think some of the alien stuff has to do with the fact that the way it started sort of reminded maybe people who read that story. There's an Arthur Clarke story called Rendezvous with Rama. It sort of begins the same way that the detection of this object began.
Yes. Sometimes, jokingly, the scientists, it has a 10-to-1 ratio of length to width. I have joked that it's a monolith. And when it was first discovered, there were people who actually wanted to call it Rama. But they thought it was too sci-fi for them. So they asked because it was found on a Hawaiian telescope, they asked a Hawaiian scientist to come up with a name for it, and that's where he came with Oumuamua. But they were thinking in terms of the same way that you were.
Roy, WS1.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, that would be pretty close. That monolith in 2001, they took the square of the first three numbers, 1, 2, and 3. And that was the dimensions. 1 to 2, I think 9. So that would be pretty close if you're saying it was a 10 to 1.
Hey,
Rich, we'll get to you. We'll get to you in a moment. Well, yeah. The other problem I have is there's a lot of artists' interpretations of Oumuamua. You can find them all over the web. But again, if you take a look at my image, it's just a kind of blotchy white reflection. We know that it's not a regular surface because as it tumbles, its reflectivity changes all over the place. So we know that it's irregularly shaped. It's not terribly reflective. We know a bunch of things. I don't think it's really a monolith because I think we would be able to pick that up, that type of symmetry, by its rotation. So it's much more irregularly shaped. It's kind of like a cigar-shaped object.
Okay. Too bad we didn't pick it up sooner enough that we could have had a robotic mission go out to visit this thing and see what it really looked like. Oh, well, we'll have to wait for the next one. You know, with this smoke this far, maybe there's more coming. I heard Rich again.
We'll get to you, Rich, any moment now. I just want to finish this little thread. Well, as I said, there are millions of objects flying all over the place. So as we get better and better telescopes, we'll pick up more and more of these things. The problem is even we would have to be clairvoyant. We would have had to have predicted its existence and its location long before it got to us because it's traveling so fast that all the rockets that we own can't go that fast. We couldn't reach it if we wanted to. It's just going faster than our technology can get it at this particular point. So, Rich, what did you want to say?
Okay, boy. I guess I'm being a little philosophical. My buddy of a long time, like 45 years of him friends with Barry, M2MB, and he's of the belief that we've been looking and looking and looking. Nobody's out there, so he believes we're the only civilization, the only planet that has life. I don't believe he's correct. I think we're not looking properly. We're thinking in terms of radio. Maybe there's some other things. Also looking, I believe, the 1100 megacycles. That's where we assume other civilizations would contact. I don't know if we're assuming properly. If you ever looked at the word assume, it makes an ass out of you and me.
Yeah, and I remember the Odd Couple, a television show that used that line back in the 60s. Well, I mean, I can't tell you for sure or not what's going on, and no one can. The problem, though, is much bigger than a lot of people tend to give it. There's at least something like 1 or 2 trillion galaxies in this universe. There's probably a lot more. Each galaxy probably has roughly, give or take, 100, 200 billion stars. Most of those probably have planets. It's theoretically possible that some of those planets could be in the right place at the right time to have life, because it's an inherent characteristic of carbon, and carbon's a very, very common material that's given off on supernovas. So there's probably life, but it's very, very spread out. It takes light years to get to the nearest star system. It takes millions of years for light to get to the next galaxy. It just takes way too much time. If you really think about it, we've only been transmitting RF in what, about 120 years, give or take? So that's just a hiccup in the time frame of the galaxy. So the problem is not that we haven't heard it so it doesn't exist. The problem is it's too spread out and we don't have enough time to look in too many places to find anything.
Are you making sense, boy? I have a question for you. Maybe you know more about it than me. The kiss board or whatever. What is it now? In New Mexico, government said it was a weather balloon. Dick said that there was a book published. They interviewed people on their deathbed who had nothing to lose, and they all said it was a spacecraft. What do you know?
What do I know? I don't know anything because I wasn't there. What do is my understanding? What do I think? I don't think it was much of anything. I think it was blown out of all proportion. I think it's a test site for government aircraft that they would rather not talk about, but they really probably, if you have to know they exist, they feel that you're better off thinking it's a place where they park UFOs than where they do a experimental planes and rockets and such. I think memories are awful. They're very plastic, very pliable. You could talk people into almost anything. The worst witness is an eyewitness because they often say they see things that never happened. So I don't think aliens have visited us. I don't think they visited us next to a testing site for secret government weapons.
Well, this conjecture to the whole thing always be a mystery. Okay, boy. No, I respect your opinion. I guess we would all like to believe, I don't know why, the aliens have been here. I really don't know why I want to believe that, but I do. And to you.
Well, there's a lot of things that we like to think of. We like to think that there was an ancient civilization of brilliant people on Atlantis who had equipment that is much more scientific than ours, and then they were destroyed. We have this weird desire for golden ages of things, and so one of those variations on the civilization of Atlantis is von Däniken's belief in distant aliens who came and taught us. I think that cheapens humans' ability to conceive of things, design things, and build things, to kind of devolve the Great Pyramids as something that a bunch of aliens handed over to us. Kind of cheapens humanity for me. So I tend to revel in the fact that humanity is capable of great, great things, and there's more than enough evidence. And I see no reason to give aliens the credit for it. Yes, Wesley.
I don't know. We could talk a bit about the Sinek wave.
Say again?
The Sinek waves.
Okay, I got the waves. I don't kind of get the first word.
Z-E-N-N-E-C-K.
The neck waves?
Is correct.
Does the neck waves have something to do with the previous conversation? Because I'm not quite sure.
No, it is not, but it's related to ham radio. And it's related to our big $500 million business that is taking advantage of Tesla. The technology and the delivery of the electricity without the wires.
I actually did that story, I think, about 3 weeks ago. There's a company in Texas that has, and I sent you an image of it and a link to it. They have something that looks a lot like Tesla's experimental lab, the big ball with the electrons going on it. We kind of touched on that about 3 weeks ago.
I didn't hear it on the technet, but did you touch the phenomenon of Sinek waves?
Well, we didn't go into heavy-duty detail because there is no heavy-duty detail because the company isn't really explaining themselves. They're just very vague, and the only thing that's consistent is their... for people to invest in their company, which always causes me to be a little bit concerned. I don't think there's anything to it personally. I mean, I don't want to rain on anyone's parade, but the whole concept was that it's kind of like these guys never heard of Nikola Tesla or think it's 1910. Because they're trying to build the same thing, and they're trying to get investors on that, too. So it's a curious thing. It's going on in Texas. Like I said, I mentioned it. And if you go to my little website, there's a couple of nice pictures of Tesla's version of this and the one down south in Texas.
What strikes me is that Zenek wave is described by them as the zero-phase sequence, non-Hertzian radiation of northern ground wave radiation. In some other papers that they have, they explain it as a Hawking wave. And because it's very low frequency, that each of the hopes is quite long. They want to soon to cover the whole Earth, and since the Zenek wave